Merle Gold was really a pioneer, being one of the first Playboy bunnies.
A bunny in the 1960s made great money, and we were like rock stars.
Playboy can give you the taste of the high life, but that doesn't last forever.
She just blew through all the money and one day woke up and realized there was nothing left.
Charlie said to Carol that if she didn't back him up, he was going to divorce her.
She says she knew she was paying $75 a month into something, but didn't really know what.
Just a few minutes into his conversation with detectives, he realizes, oh, wait a minute. This is about a murder.
That was the beginning of my worst nightmare.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Docu Talk Through, the podcast where I talk you through the best documentaries in the streaming sphere. This is episode 21.
And this is going to be part 4 of the 6-part series titled The Playboy Murders, streaming on Max. And the title of this episode 4 is Black Bart and the Bunny. Let's go ahead and get into it. Okay, this episode starts out October 20th, 10:30 p.m. in Phoenix, Arizona. And this is 1992. So we hear Brittany Whitney talking, and we see this police car. We see the inside of this police car. The police is driving, and there's a woman who had called 911 saying her husband had been shot. And Brianna Whitney, and she's a reporter for Arizona's Family. So this lady called, her husband's been shot. They rush over, the cops get there, and we see, you know, in reenactment of the cops in the house, it's all dark except for like a table lamp in the front room, like right in the front entrance, there's a table lamp, but everything else is dark. The cops have their flashlights out, and we're looking from one room to where the cops enter, and already you can see there's a phone on the wall, and you can see blood on the phone, on like the handset. And the cops come into that room, and they look on the ground. They see 51-year-old Chuck Gold. He's found dead inside his home. And we see like a newspaper sitting on a table, and there's like another bloody handprint next to that newspaper on like this, like a coffee table, or it's more like a kitchen counter. So this Chuck Gold guy is dead, and we see a picture of Chuck Gold. He must be the Black Bart in this episode, I'm thinking. So we see this guy, Joe Petrosino. He's a former Phoenix detective. You notice all these names of these cops, all their names sound like Italian. Like even from the previous episodes, they have these names sound like they straight out of general casting out of these movies. All right. So we see the cop picking up these shell casings off the floor, and we hear Petrosino saying that Mr. Gold, he was murdered by multiple gunshots, and his wife is the person who discovered him. His wife is Carol. And so we see a picture of Chuck Gold, and I'm thinking this is Carol. And Chuck Gold give me like he could be Tom Selleck's cousin or something like that. He has like, I don't know, for some reason he remind me of Tom Selleck. And Carol remind me of Suzanne Summers. She got a Suzanne Summers thing going on. But we see a picture of them both, and you can tell this is an older, well, of course it's an older picture, but we see them. He has his hand around her shoulders, and they look happy. So we hear Holly Madison giving us some background on Carol Gold. So Carol Gold was 53 years old when her husband Chuck was found brutally murdered. And so we hear Holly saying this is a dramatic turn from decades ago when this woman was on a very different path. And so I guess Carol Gold, she was working as a Playboy bunny, and she was experiencing this glamorous lifestyle that we've been hearing about over the courses of the previous 3 episodes. I guess, you know, if you were, I mean, it was for not being like a actor or rock star, you know, those kind of celebrities, this was the next best thing, being one of these Playboy bunnies. This was the lifestyle. It had a lot of perks. It was glamorous. Even if I'm not sure how much money they made really, because I think it was the very first episode, they talked about money there, but they more talk about the lifestyle, the benefits, the perks, the access you get with being associated with Playboy. Okay, so she does mention, she said making more money than she ever thought was possible. So she had the bag. And we see these vintage Playboy. We see this one, Marilyn Monroe, and this Playboy cover looks like someone cut a picture of Marilyn Monroe out, pasted it on like a white sheet of paper, and stenciled the word Playboy on the top, and just cut and paste some other graphics on it. So this is not the Playboy that I grew up with. This is vintage. This is like granddad's, great granddad's Playboy. So Carol was involved with the Playboy company at a very early stage in the early 60s. Wow, holy cow. I guess I didn't realize Playboy had been around that long, to 60s? So how was Hugh Hefner when he started? All right, so we hear Holly just giving us some more history. She's saying back then the magazine looked very homemade, just like I was saying. It looked homemade, looked cut and paste, and it wasn't like the glossy magazine that we see now.
Hef started Playboy when he was 27 years old. He started HMH Publishing at the same time. HMH Publishing is his initials, Hugh Marston Hefner, and he just started that publishing company to do Playboy. The first issue came out in December of 1953. He didn't put a volume number on the first issue because he wasn't sure if there'd be a second one. The first nude pictorial in Playboy was a photo of Marilyn Monroe, and that feature would go on to become the centerfold feature.
Man, I wonder how much that copy of Playboy with Marilyn Monroe as the cover in the centerfold. And I think that was mentioned back in the first episode where that, I'm so horrible with names, but she became the centerfold and the cover. And I think Marilyn Monroe and Anna Nicole, one other person it's only been three people that's done that, I think, if I remember correctly. But so 27, that answers my question. How old was he when he started this? He was 27 years old. Man, when I hear stories about these people, we only know them from one thing. It goes to show, when you lock your mind on something, you just gotta go to course, man. And that's why I failed it. I started so many things. I mean, I started out on a trajectory with one thing in mind, but it fizzled. And I've seen other people who I know who started out, but, you know, success still came, but just not in the thing we wanted. And maybe, you know, before 27, maybe he did try other stuff, but before he was 30, he started this and had the wherewithal to start a publishing company just for the magazine. He didn't go to another publisher. He started the publishing company to publish his own magazine. And I don't think that's uncommon now, but I bet that wasn't done a lot back then. So anyway, so we hear Holly giving some more background. You know, at the time there wasn't really anything like Playboy. There were nude magazines, but they were all like small scale. You know, it wasn't anything massive like what he was doing. And I guarantee they didn't have Marilyn Monroe. I guarantee you that. So he wanted this different thing. So the Playboy lifestyle, as opposed to other sort of things that's tied to like nudity, like these nude magazines like Hustler, Penthouse. There's a documentary on Penthouse, but I don't think it's streaming. I saw it on the ad in the hotel. On I can't remember what channel, but it may be on like ID channel or something, but I forgot all about Penthouse. I forgot about Penthouse magazine. But Playboy was supposed to be an aspirational, upscale men's kind of fantasy lifestyle magazine. And I think that's where Playboy, where Hugh Hefner wanted to set himself apart. And also, I think that's why he was more choosy or a little bit pickier with his women. So now we get some background on Carol. Now, Carol, she was originally from Chicago. And in 1955, she was a model in her teenage years. We're hearing this from Brianna Whitney, that journalist, again, that reporter. So she did a lot of magazines, a lot of commercials, things like that. And then we see this reenactment of her modeling. And it's definitely not anything salacious or anything. I mean, she's just modeling like she's doing a photo shoot for a toilet paper commercial or like a Tide commercial. You know, like a home goods commercial. Definitely not bathing suit or anything like that. So that's how she started in the public eye. She was just doing these regular modeling stuff. I remember when I was in the Air Force, one of our female lieutenants, she was a model for like Kohl's and Kmart. So we would get like the Sunday magazines. I mean, the Sunday newspaper, you know how they had all the sales inserts in there. We would see her. And no, it was weird, man. We would see her in some of those ads, like Kmart and stuff like that. It was weird. So this is what this reminds me of. So when Carol was 15, she had a friend who worked nearby for HMH Publishing. That's right. That's in Chicago. I think I learned that in one of the previous episodes. I thought the whole home base for Playboy was in California, was in LA somewhere, Hollywood. But no, it's in Chicago. HMH Publishing is in Chicago. So we see this ad. It says, we need file clerks. And this is an ad for HMH Publishing. It says, we are expanding the subscription department of HMH Publishing Company. We need file clerks, general office clerks. So her friend went to Carol and said, hey, Carol, maybe you should come down and apply for one of these jobs. So... But Carol was in the Catholic school, and we hear this from another person, Mitzi. So Carol was going to the Catholic school, and in order for you to have a job, you have to get approved by the Catholic priest. And this is Mitzi Hargrave Schmidt, and she's one of Carol's friends. So of course, when she goes and say, "Hey, I'm getting this job at this HMH Publishing." She's not going to say Playboy. And actually, I'm not even sure if she even knew it was Playboy, but yeah, it's just a publishing company. I'm going to do some clerk work, some filing, whatever. It's just a publishing company. And the Catholic priest, not knowing in the bed, was like, yeah, that's fine. And he didn't understand HMH meant Hugh M. Hefner. So, and we see this picture of young Hugh Hefner, and he still looks... So if this is him at 27, he looks 57. So he's always had this old person look, and he's holding up a Playboy. And this is June 1963 issue of Playboy. So and we see him with a pipe in his mouth. He's still got that pipe in his mouth. And so Carol goes, she meet with an executive, and they liked it. He liked it. He hired her right on the spot. So now she got a foot in the door. See, this is something I didn't understand when I was growing up. I didn't understand, hey, just get your foot in the door. Get your foot, whatever you want to do, get your foot in the door. I didn't learn that until my 40s. Get your foot in the door and then progress from there. So that's what she did. She got a foot in the door of this HMH Publishing. Now, I guess she maybe did have ulterior motives because she was already modeling. So maybe she did. They haven't said that, but maybe she did. And we see these shots of the very first Playboy Club. And this very first one opened in Chicago on February 29th in 1960. And it was like an upscale place for men to go. And of course, it was private. You could have lunch, dinner there. And we see all these vintage footage of this Playboy Club. And we see the bunnies. And they remind, like, you know, even like, I don't know if back then the way they dressed would be like, you know, something like taboo, but it looks a lot different. It's the bunny suits here that they're showing now are pink. as opposed to the black that I think they wear now. But these are pink. And so pretty much the Playboy bunnies then, oh no, I see there's a girl with black, a black one on. But and so the Playboy bunnies, they were just like the wait staff, the hostess. They were just the people that worked at the club, you know, instead of, you know, like suits or skirts or whatever. They got on a little bunny costume. And he's and Holly is describing this as a corset with tights.
When Heffer started the magazine, he decided on the rabbit as a symbol and a logo because rabbits are very playful animals and they have a lot of sex.
This is my Playboy bunny picture. This is from Chicago. That was a really great job.
And we see this lady. Her name is Diana Peterson Farraco, and she's a former Playboy bunny. And yeah, so, you know, you can imagine, like, I'm telling you this, man, time is the great equalizer. But I can appreciate I can appreciate when women just get old naturally and don't try to, women and men. Sometimes I see, when I travel, I see these dudes, these men, like, what, trying to, I mean, you can tell they're older, like my age or older, but they won't let trying to look younger, they won't let it go. Just, but you know, I can look at her and tell she was a hottie back in her day. And she's actually showing one of her Playboy bunny pictures. And yeah, man, what I can say, it looks like as opposed to now, Hef chose thicker women back then, like voluptuous women, which to me is always more attractive than like stick skinny with fake boobs or butt lift. Voluptuous women, like curvy, and you can tell based on if you watch this docuseries, and if you look at this one so far, these have been the oldest. This has been the oldest, based off one of the oldest bunnies. And look at the newer models, way different, man. So she's talking about, you know, it was a great job. And she's saying the definition of a bunny in the 1960s was the girl next door, but somebody that was sexy and beautiful. I think that's what they go for now, the girl next door look. And that, and you know, when they said the girl next door, I know there's an avatar for the girl next door. Blonde hair, blue eyes, white girl. That's the avatar for the, but growing up for me, I know who the girl next door was. I know who the girl next door was. And when I grew up, that's the image. Every time I hear that term, the girl next door, I have a specific vision of the girl who I grew up next to, the girl next door, who was hands off. Her parents kept her lock and key. And you know what happened when she finally got out? Boop, baby bumps. But yeah, so she's saying the girl next door, that's who, what the definition of the Playboy bunny back then. And she said even in the 1960s, the bunnies made great money and they were like rock stars. Man, if I was a girl, that would be my, well, actually, never mind. Based on these series, this six documentary series, I want to know how many Playboy bunnies are tied to murders. Because, you know, this, it's got to be more than six. If this thing started out in the 60s, I wonder if there's going to be another season of this. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. So, yeah, so she's saying they were like rock stars. The money they made was life-changing. In Chicago, they made more money. There were more celebrities that came to Chicago Club. So Carol started off as a switchboard operator in Playboy's first offices. And we finally get to see a picture of Carol in her vintage Playboyness. And yeah, man, she just looked like a cute girl. Her hair in this picture is she's a brunette. In the picture they showed when she was standing next to Chuck, when I said she was giving me Susan Summers vibes, she had her hair blonde and two little ponytails. You know how like Suzanne Summers used to wear those two pigtails on the side in Three's Company? But here she got a short cut hair and she's a brunette. And so they use Carol as a fit bunny, whatever that is. And oh, okay. So in order to design the costumes, she was a fit buddy. So they just used her to fit the costumes that the girls wore when the club opened. So she was one of the original body models for the damn costume. That tells you how, you know, what kind of shape her body was in if they used her as the mannequin. And then after that, she became a bunny. So she was one of the first bunnies. So she's one of the OGs. And remember, she's coming from a Catholic school background. But, you know, come on, let's not pretend. We know about the Catholic school girls. So Carol was always, since she was an OG, she was also appointed to supervise some of the other girls. And, you know, we hear Diane saying she was always kind. She was always nice. She was easy to work for. But if you stepped out of line, she would tell you. So she was supervising a get together. And it was a get together with Frank Sinatra and some of his friends, probably the Red Pack. And so she was organizing this thing and supervising this thing. And so Sinatra asks her, you know, who are you? Started talking to her. And then she just said, you know, may I get you something?
And he goes, well, no, I just want to know who you are. You can sit and talk to me. And she said, Mr. Sinatra, I'd absolutely love to. And I think you're amazing, but I have to take care of everything here.
So, yeah, she sounded like a class act, man. You know, old Blue Eyes was trying to hit on her. She was like, you know, partner, I'm on a job. I love to chill out with you, but I'm on a job. Let me do my job. So it sounded like she had a head on her shoulders as far as like priorities and keeping business. And we just hear Holly saying that, you know, of course this was a life change for Carol. And the money was good. And it was just a lifestyle change. But it seems like it didn't go to her head. It seems like she was sort of falling in place and getting used to it real quick. You know, it wasn't blowing her mind. She kept it professional. And it seemed like she appreciated her come up. So while she was working as a Playboy bunny, she put herself through school. Not only that, she became a teacher and taught eighth grade at a Catholic school. So, you know, you hear of strippers. I'm definitely not equating Playboy bunnies to strippers. I'm not. But I'm just saying, like, I've only been to one strip club once in my entire life. And that was for an officer when I was in the Air Force. An officer was getting married. And we all end up getting kicked out. Actually, you know what? I'm going to say that story for another time. But anyway, so she put herself through school. She got a teacher's license, teaching degree, whatever you had to do back then. And she went on to teach school. And Holly's saying is that it was crazy that by day she was this Catholic school teacher. And then at night, she threw on the bunny ears, the corset, and the tights. And she was working as a Playboy bunny at night. So during this time, she met an engineering student. His name was Kenny Cattini, and they got married. So Carol, she worked at the Playboy Club for 5 years. And so she was at the Playboy Club for 5 years before she and Kenny ended up moving to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And they worked at horse stables. Okay, so was that was the end of her Playboy career? So now we're in Wisconsin and we're inside this horse stable. And we hear Brianna again. She's saying that's when tragedy struck. So we're doing this drone flyover of this horse prairie. We see these horses. These horses running in the field. I guess Kenny was in a riding accident and he died shortly after that. And this is Stephanie Gold who's telling us this. And Stephanie Gold is Chuck Gold's daughter. So we get this from the guy at the beginning who was found murdered. This is his daughter. She's telling us that Kenny, who was Carol's husband, he was in a horse accident. He died. So he was running barrels at a horse show. And we see a reenactment of this. And I'm thinking running barrels is when a horse runs around the barrels. Is it barrel racing? Is that the same thing? But so we see this guy riding on the horses around these barrels. And then he slipped and fell out of his saddle and he never gained consciousness. So when he died, it not only left Carol as a widow, but I guess they had a daughter. They skipped over that. So she was a single mom now, a widowed single mom and a newborn son. Well, hold up. Okay. All right, documentary. Y'all kind of skipped over a lot. So evidently, Kenny and Carol had two kids. They have a newborn who was born the same year he died, same year Kenny died, and they had another daughter. Wow. So I guess Carol, she stayed there. She was working at the stables, raising these two kids, and she reconnected with a childhood friend and enters Chuck Gold. And we see this older picture of, and they are a handsome couple, a very handsome couple. And Chuck also had two kids. So, you know, together they got four kids. Okay, so we see this is Stephanie. Stephanie Gold. So we see an older picture of her. And she's saying her relationship with her dad in her earlier years, it was sporadic. So she wasn't real close with her dad in her earlier years. They divorced before she was 2 years old. And so Stephanie and her mom, they live with her mom parents. So they live with her grandparents on her mom's side. So when Chuck and Carol started dating, that was in 1977. About a year later, they headed to Las Vegas and they got married. So Carol used her Playboy connections to get them set up at the Lake Geneva Playboy Resort. So we see this ad, it says something for everyone at Lake Geneva Playboy. That seems like a weird place for a Playboy resort. Okay, so this is the very first offshoot of the Playboy Club. This Lake Geneva Playboy Resort. So this is the first offshoot of the Playboy Club. And this is a kind of a bigger, better experience. This is a whole full resort. And it was more modern. They had ski trails. They had golf courses. They had stables. And it was just like a huge retreat with the Playboy name attached to it. And so we see this thing and it's just definitely different from Chicago. It's just acres and acres of trees and just greenery, just fields and grass. And so Carol, she loved the horses. And so her and Chuck went on to open their own stable at the Playboy Club at Lake Geneva. So we hear Stephanie again. She's saying Carol was very good for her husband. They had a great dynamic relationship. They worked well together. They ride together. They did everything together. And by the summer of 1982, Chuck and Carol knew they were going to leave Lake Geneva. And the reason why they were leaving is because the winters were so, it was just too much for everybody. So are the winters there worse than Chicago? I think it's be pretty similar, right? But whatever. So evidently the winters were too rough for them. So they decided to go to the total opposite climate, Arizona. Man, I was in Arizona. Well, I'm in Vegas now. And man, it was like 109 today. I don't think I could get used to it. And I was in Arizona last week. And again, I think it got like 105, 107 there. So anyway, they moved to Arizona for the warmer weather and pretty much summer year round. So Carol and Chuck, when they moved, they only took Carol's kids, her daughter Allison and her son Ashton. So they didn't bring, I guess Chuck's kids must have been with their mom. They got hooked up with this resort, Point Hilton Resort at Tapatio Cliffs. So they were running these stables there at Point Hilton Resort. So Chuck Gold, in addition to running the stables, he had another gig. He would organize these gunfight reenactments around town at different hotels and other resorts. And this is where he got the name Black Bart. This is where the Black Bart in the title come from. So the original Black Bart was a gunslinger from the 1880s.
My dad would bring people in and he'd be dressed as Black Bart and people would just get a kick out of it. And Carol was the person responsible for all of the accounting and paying the bills and doing all of that stuff. That was Carol's role.
by 1992. Cash flow was not an issue at that stable. They had a going business, and that was without Chuck. And I can imagine when you add in the gunfight shows and the things that he did, they were doing quite well.
So they had these two businesses. I almost said businesses. They had these two businesses going. One, a fairly common, you know, stable business, horse stables and horse tours and things like that. But then also this niche gunslinger reenactment, gunfight type thing. With both of these businesses, they were making a pretty good living, according to all accounts so far. So where is it going to go dark? They keep talking about these two businesses and talking about how much money they're making. So I'm thinking it's going to have something to do with that. Let's find out. So far, their life is pretty idyllic. You know, she goes from Playboy to running these stables to having this gunfight reenactment thing. And I don't know what Chuck did before. I don't think they mentioned what Chuck did before. But, you know, she was a teacher, so she dabbled in both worlds. She's had a stable, regular 9-to-5, but she also has these fantasy type careers. And everything is going good for him. But on the night of October 20th, all of that, the idyllic lifestyle, the fantasy jobs, fantasy businesses, all went out the window. So Chuck and Carol, they got married in December of 1978. And by December of 1992, they would have been married 14 years. So 2 months before Chuck was found dead, it would have been 14 years. So we're going back to this October 20th. 1992. We hear Breonna Whitney again. So Carol was at dinner with her daughter, Allison. And from there, they ended up going back to Allison's house. And they watched the movies, hung out, you know, had some mama-daughter time. And then we hear the detective, Petrosino, he's saying that Chuck was supposed to be at a conference. But then at some point, he called Carol and said he was on his way home. So at that point, Carol said, okay, well, you know, I want to be there when he gets home, so I'm going to head home. So Carol gets home around 10:30 p.m. She walks into the house, and that's when she finds Chuck shot dead in the kitchen. She picks up the phone, dial 911. She must have touched him because we see her pick up that phone that they showed earlier with the blood on it. So she must have touched him or something. So we hear Chuck's daughter, Stephanie, again. She said she got a phone call, and it was Richard Feingold on the phone. And Richard Feingold was Chuck's friend. And he tells Stephanie that her dad is dead. And she said she didn't even believe the first time she heard it. So she asked him three different times. And he said that, you know, your dad's dead. He was shot tonight. And that's all the information he had for her at that point. So she lost it. And she said that was the beginning of her worst nightmare. So Chuck Gold had been shot in the head with 8 22 caliber bullets. Well, not necessarily in the head, but he was shot in the head. He was bleeding from the head. And there was 8 casings laying around him. So definitely shot in the head, but don't know if all 8 were shot in the head. All 8 bullets was in the head. So they processed the scene. The front door was locked. There was no sign of break-in. And this is Petrosino. He's saying he walked around. He looked at different things.
And I discovered that one of the back doors is unlocked. The back door should be locked, and it's not. Your first thought is that, well, maybe it's a burglary gone bad. If that's the case, you will normally see things disturbed, but none of that appeared to be the case.
So, of course, in these situations, you know, when there's a significant other, when there's a spouse, whatever, and also being that Carol is the one to discover them, of course they're going to talk to her. So the lead detective pulls Carol outside and start asking her, trying to get a timeline on what happened. Carol tells the detective that they had a really good relationship. There was nothing wrong. Everything was going good. Things were well. But she indicated that in the past, old Chuck was stepping out a little bit. But, you know, she forgave him. You know, he got his little side piece. She forgave him. and everything was all good. That was in the past. So old Black Bart went out there and dipped his wick in somebody else. But everything is all good, according to her. She got past it. So just think, this dude married a former Playboy bunny. He goes out there and cheat on her. The detectives, you know, they start doing their thing, start to dig deeper, started to talk to everybody, anyone associated with Chuck, anyone associated with the family, anyone who knows about their relationship. So they reach out to Richard Feingold, the guy who called Stephanie. They reach out to this guy to get his story, see how much he knows, see what's going on. So Feingold told Petrosino that, yeah, you know, Chuck was kind of a hard guy to get along with, and he may have a lot of enemies. So that's his friend saying it. Imagine that. That's his friend saying this. Richard tells the detective also that a number of years ago, Chuck had been in a relationship with a lady that worked at the horse stables named Linda. So this must be the this old side piece that Carol mentioned. So she actually worked at the same stables that they operated. You know, it's one thing to fuck around, but you're going to do it that close? I guess he was so close to this chick that he was going to divorce Carol. Wow. So Carol kind of diminished the seriousness of it. That's more than a little cheating. If you're going to leave your wife for this chick, that's past just dipping your wick. That's emotional. And so the detective Petrosino is saying there's even evidence that Linda lived in the house at some point. So where was Carol? What? Wait a minute. So the detective is saying that when the divorce was final between Carol and Chuck, that Linda was going to go move in with him, whether it was, you know, sort of like a, like where they were going to get married or whatever. But she was definitely going to come to live there with him. And also there's signs, there's evidence that she actually lived there even without Carol and Chuck being divorced. So either Carol was living for something somewhere else, or old Black Bart would just had his game so tight that he had two women living in the house together. But Chuck ended up ending the relationship with Linda for whatever reason. They don't know why. So this was around, Stephanie is saying this was around October of 91. So a year before the October 20th, 1992. So Stephanie says she knew that her daughter, I mean, Stephanie is saying she knew that her father had affairs, plural, multiple affairs, and Carol knew about them. This is coming from Stephanie. So Carol knew about all these affairs he was having. And Stephanie is saying she believed Carol had affairs. And she's saying that she's sure that her father knew about them as well. So they were just kind of like open, I guess. And so she's saying, I don't necessarily know that I would call it unfaithful, because they knew and there was that dynamic. So they were just kind of like, okay, well, if they were just, well, why would Carol say, why would she, when the detective was asking her questions, why wouldn't she just say that? If they had like an open relationship, they both were fucking around and each other knew it, then that's different. If they all right with it, then there's no problem with it. But you know, anyway, so yeah, it's not if it's an open marriage and they all and they're in agreement, it's not being unfaithful. That's just what they do. So the detective started to interview the employees at the horse stables, and one of them has a story that Carol had a 14-year-old grandson named Ronnie, and that's Allison's son. And at some point, Ronnie was staying with Chuck and Carol because Carol's daughter, Allison, was out of town. So grandson came to stay with grandma because mom is out of town. And so we hear from Petrosino. He's saying that when Ronnie came to stay with them, Chuck was expecting Ronnie to work at the stables. Like, you know, there's no free ride. You come stay with us, you got to get your ass out and work. That's what Chuck was expecting. And Ronnie didn't want to do that. He wanted to go hang out with his girlfriend. He had no plans of going to the stables. So why would Chuck just assume this kid is going to go work at the damn stables? Like, it seems like that should be something that's talked about before he come to stay with them. Like, I don't understand how that's an assumption. So anyway, he told Chuck that you know, I'm not working in no damn stables. I'm gonna hang out with my girl. But Chuck got pissed off and told him, no, you got to get to the stables. So, you know, Ronnie didn't show up to the stables, and Chuck got butthurt. He sort of lost it, and he told Ronnie not to come to the house. He said, you can't stay here no more. Man, that dude sounded like an asshole. I mean, again, if it was an agreement before he came to live with them or to came to stay with them, that's one thing. But you just assume because somebody come and stay, they're going to work at your damn stables? Like, is it a job or is that like, you know, paying off his stay? He's supposed to be step granddad. So
stable hands at the resort said they saw Chuck and Ronnie arguing loudly over the incident. As a result, Ronnie ran away. And this all took place just a week before Chuck's murder.
Oh, shit. So this was just a week before old dude was found shut up. Okay, so we got two possible suspects so far. We got Carol and we got Ronnie. And so we learned from Petrosino that Ronnie had some run-ins with the cops before. And he was known for having a bit of a temper. And so, but they ultimately find out that Ronnie was with his girlfriend when Chuck was murdered. So he has an alibi. And the next day, he was at school. And, you know, when they came to talk to him, he didn't even know Chuck was killed. He didn't even know shit about it until they came to the school and got him. So we hear from Pat LaLama. She's a journalist. And she's saying that the weeks before Chuck Gold's murder, he was in a blowout with somebody else. And that was Ashton, who's Carol's son. So this dude, he gets into it with Carol's grandson. Then he also gets into it with Carol's son. So at the time, Ashton was 20 years old and he lived with Carol and Chuck. And Ashton, according to Stephanie, was a quiet dude. He was a quiet person. And he worked at the stables. So he did work at the stables and he resented working at the stables. So he was always in like a grumpy ass mood for having to work at this stable now I see why. So Chuck thought that Ronnie was going to do this because I guess if you come stay with Chuck, you got to work at the stable. So I can see how, I mean, you got to know this dude has a bit of a temper or something. I know he was young and he really didn't have any say so because his mom was out of town, but nah, man, if you know it's a hostile environment or a place you don't want to go, don't go. Ashton is 20, so he could fucking leave. He could leave. Like you don't be resentful and work at a fucking place that you don't have to because you living at these people's house. He's 20. You leave. Anyway, so Petrosino is saying that he found out that Ashton had a history of abusing hard drugs. What's hard drugs? Crack? But okay, so we're talking about opioids. So Ashton was hooked on opioids and he owed people money for his drug habit. So people were fronting him drugs, opioids, and he needed to pay up. So now we got more probable suspects. So he was addicted to a drug called Nubian. Never even heard of that. The hell is Nubian? Okay, so according to Stephanie, Nubian is a steroid, and it's used for what people use steroids for. So why did the detective say opioid? That's two conflicting type of drugs, an opioid and a steroid? Huh. Okay, so Chuck told Stephanie that Ashton had got caught smoking weed at the stables. Okay, so we went from opioids to the steroids to weed. Okay, so maybe they're saying he was on all this shit. He's on an opioid, he's on a steroid, and he's smoking the reefer. When Chuck caught him smoking weed at the stables, that pissed him off. He got livid because it was their livelihood and marijuana, of course, wasn't legal then. So, you know, so that would jeopardize. So if someone from the resort caught this dude smoking weed on the property, they could lose their contract. Okay, I get that. Yeah, dude, man, go smoke weed at home. Like, all right. So, yeah, I can see how he would lose it. That's valid. You smoke, you're going to jeopardize this contract I got with this resort because you smoking fucking weed. But yeah, he lost it. And so Stephanie's saying one of her last conversations with her dad was about Ashton, and things were getting complicated, and he didn't really know how much longer he was going to be able to keep it together with this baggage and shit, you know, Ashton and her grandkid, you know, he was just kind of like on the brink of just losing. And it seems like this stuff happens like all within like a small period of time before he died, before he was found murdered. So Chuck had decided to actually just go ahead and kick Ashton out the damn house. So when the detectives found, you know, they find this out, like, you know, that they had this big blow up. Ashton was getting kicked out. They go to talk to Ashton, but Ashton tell them, hey, it's no big deal. We smoothed everything over. Everything was fine. He minimizes this whole thing. He's like, no, it wasn't that big of a deal. Everything was fine. And Ashton also had an alibi for the night Chuck was found murdered. He was with his girlfriend and they were in public, and there were other witnesses. There were people that could verify where he was. So you know, got Ronnie, he was with his girlfriend, got an alibi. And we got Ashton, he was with his girlfriend and got an alibi. Carol, she was with her daughter, so she has an alibi. But detectives get a call from a family member who said Ashton was out looking at new Cadillacs. Okay. Now remember, Ashton working this job at the stables that he don't like. He owed people money for drugs he can't pay for. He's getting kicked out of the house. He's out looking at Cadillacs. And so the family member also said that, so the family member thought something, they thought that looked suspicious. Yeah, man, like who, what fucking 20-year-old is out that's not rich is out looking at Cadillacs? And they didn't say what family member it was. It just said a family member. So this is 2 weeks after Chuck was found dead. So this is 2 weeks after this dude Ashton, he's out looking at Cadillacs. So on November 5th of 1992, so 2 weeks after the murder, the detectives go back to talk to Carol again. And when they brought up Ashton to Carol, and supposedly the fight that he and Chuck had, she talked about the fact that, you know, yeah, Ashton was you know, doing some drugs, and Chuck told Carol that if she didn't back him up on how to deal with Ashton, you know, getting kicked out of the house, he was going to divorce her. So he's using that as a chess piece, which is fucked up. Like if you have a you know, like a stipulation like that, if you don't do this, we get divorced, then it's over anyway. You know what I mean? Because evidently it sounds like she wants to stay married more than he does. So that's his thing to hang over her head. If you don't do this, we're getting a divorce. Well, you might as well get a divorce anyway. If you have something like that, you can hang over somebody's head. Like, you know, I don't care. You either back me up on this or we're done. But I get it. I mean, I can get it. Like, if you got a stepkid and they're causing trouble, especially drugs and shit like that, then she should want to back them up, for one. So yeah, man, that's the thing. That's why, you know, don't take on other people's baggage. That's one of the things that come, and I hear this all the time, man. I hear this a lot, where the stepkid comes, you know, either the stepkid or baby mama or baby daddy, shit like that gets in the way of a marriage. But anyway, that's what he's hanging over her head. And Carol tells the cops this, but she believed that Ashton and Chuck had worked out the problem. Whatever upset Chuck, everything was smooth over. That, so she tells this sort of the same story that Ashton told. So whatever Ashton, if this is true, whatever Ashton said to Chuck to calm him down or to smooth everything over, it must have been big, man. So when asked about owing people money for drugs, Kara said that they discovered that he owed about $1,200 to somebody and they just paid it off for him. So they gave him the money to pay off this drug dealer. That $1,200, that don't seem like a lot of money. I thought it was going to be like $30,000. But yeah, I mean, I guess people have been murdered for smaller amounts of money. But you know, they got the money, they gave it to him, and he went and paid him off. So, and that was supposed to be the end of it. But at some point in the investigation, the detectives get a call from the insurance company. And Petrosino is saying, that's not uncommon. Like, in situations like this, a lot of times the insurance companies, they contact the investigators. Because remember, insurance companies don't want to pay out. The insurance companies do not want to pay out. So they're going to find, you know, whatever. They're looking for reasons. They're not looking for reasons to pay out. They're looking for reasons not to pay out. So, of course, they're going to call the investigators to make sure, hey, whoever the beneficiary is, you know, are they a suspect? Are they on an investigation? Whatever, because we're going to hold his money as long as possible. And so their question to the investigators was, is anybody in the family involved? Because this insurance policy was for $150,000. And it's in accidental death insurance. So that's not an accidental death. So, yeah, that's a murder. Eight bullet casings? No, that's not an accidental death. And so on the side of Carol, it's not like as of now, it seems like he's bringing in money. So he's the, you know, they're both bringing in money, and it seems like they're bringing in their equal share. Even if it's not their equal share, he's bringing in money, and it's not like he has a gambling habit or anything like that, as far as we know now. So you normally see cases where, you know, one spouse murder another spouse to get the insurance money if they're having money problems, or if the other spouse is draining their bank account or draining their income for some reason. But in this case, it seems like everything is fine. They got two businesses. They're bringing in money. Everything is fine. Matter of fact, that's why he wanted to get rid of Ashton, because he was on the verge of jeopardizing it. So it wouldn't make sense for Carol to kill this dude for $150,000. I imagine they making that or more with these two businesses, according to all accounts so far. So it wouldn't make sense. And that's exactly what her friend is saying, that it doesn't make sense to get rid of the dude who's bringing in at least half of the income. So one of the stories that Carol had told Stephanie is that when her husband Kenny died, there was money. Like, he had, you know, there was an insurance policy, but she kind of blew through all the money. And she just woke up and realized that she was broke. So after her first husband Kenny had that horse accident, died, there was an insurance claim. She got it, but she blew that shit. She blew through it all and woke up, you know, one day, probably after a fucking bender or something, broke. So she had to start all over. Remember, she was a single mom of two when her first husband died. So she blew through all that, even with the two kids. And we hear Holly saying,
a lot of bunnies talk about how the job paid so much more just from tips than they would have made at any other job that would have been available to them in the early 60s. I think it would have been really difficult for someone like Carol, who at such a young age had such financial freedom, and that's a very hard lifestyle to transition out of.
And see, that's the trap of life. That's the trap. Because people think the more money you make, right? So you say you work just a regular job, not even anything extravagant. So you if you work a quote good job that has benefits, that you have raises, you have bonuses, things like that, right? Well, If that's all you do is work that job, you don't have any investments, anything like that. You don't have anything that you put your money into, that your money will make money regardless of how, you know, what you work. If you don't do that, if you just work your job, you get your bonuses, and you spend your money according to, like, you know, you get a little raise, so you're gonna increase your spending. Time to go get a new, more extravagant car. That's the trap, because when you make more money, it's not equal. It's not like everything is equal, like you just made more money and everything else is the same. No, you make more money, inflation happens, right? Every year by year, things go up, inflation happens. You make more money, your taxes, you get into a higher tax bracket, right? And then if you're not smart, you're going to keep spending according to what you make instead of spending based on a budget. And that's how people go broke, man. That's how people who make six figures. I'm just saying an average household that makes six figures. That's how they don't have anything. Like, and you know, you got kids, you got a budget, man. Like, I've never had money to come easy. So I don't even know what it's like to work somewhere and you're not busting your ass and then you just have all this money. You know, like what they call disposable income. I don't even know what that is, man. I'm a penny pincher. I can't imagine just blowing money. I just can't imagine that, man. But anyway, she did. She blew all the money and she started over. So when she met Chuck, she was starting over. So Stephanie's saying when she went to Phoenix after the funeral, she looked at Ashton. At that moment, she realized that Ashton was wearing a ring and a bracelet that was her grandfather's. And so Stephanie went over to Carol and she said, "Hey, I noticed that Ashton was wearing grandpa's ring." And Carol told Stephanie that Chuck said he could have that. He could have that ring and that necklace. But Stephanie called bullshit on this because of a conversation she had with her dad.
"Listen, you're mistaken. Because Dad and I talked about it last time I was here. That whatever was Grandpa's would go to me. So he would never have let Ashton wear Grandpa's ring and bracelet. Well, Steffi, he did. Well, no, Carol, he didn't. I think that's the first time I really thought about it and really went, oh my God. Are they both involved?"
Oh shit, so we're getting closer. Now remember, this is the guy that you know it's more serious than what this short documentary emphasized, but it seems like Chuck fucking despised Ashton. To me, that's what I get. It just seems like he didn't like this dude. Seemed like he was on drugs. He didn't like that. He was jeopardizing his business. He didn't like that. And I'm pretty sure he probably wasn't a hard worker. He didn't like that. And that's probably the same problem he had with his grandson. It seemed like he's a man's man. A man should be fucking working. And I get that. So we hear Mitzi Hargrave Smith, Carol's friend. She's reading this letter from Carol Gold.
"Who are you? It does not take long before the answer to that question becomes complex. When I was 25, I could answer that my name is Carol or Miss Cotini. I am the 8th grade teacher or good evening. I'm your bunny Carol. Can you imagine my 8th graders telling their parents that their teacher was a Playboy bunny? Neither could I."
So there's no context as to what that letter was. I'm not sure. Maybe they're going to answer it later. So the detective ends up confronting Carol about that accidental death policy, something she hasn't mentioned so far. Now, I don't know if there's that'll be something you just mentioned, because maybe it's different then, but nowadays, I think everybody has insurance policy. Like, isn't it common now for spouses to have insurance policies? So would that be something you just mentioned if it's not asked? I assume everybody has insurance policy. Anybody that's working and has a family. I just assume everybody has insurance policies. But even if you work at a job, isn't it like a default insurance policy? But I don't know if that's the question you just, I don't know. Now, it's one thing if they ask her and she don't say it, but is that something you just volunteer openly? So I don't think that's too weird. Oh, okay. So they did ask her and she said she didn't know about it until Chuck died. And it was Chuck who organized it. So she knew she was paying $75 a month into something. I'm not buying it. Remember, she's the business run. She handles the money. She handles the books at the business. I'm not buying it. But she's saying she didn't really know what it was. She just paid. Look, man, maybe in some relationship, but I can't pay $2 into something without my wife knowing. She'd be like, what's this Patreon shit? I'd be like, yeah, it's my Patreon. That's how I keep saying my two Patreons. That's my pleasure. What was that on? That's my pleasure. Anyway, but I mean, yeah, I know it's different in different relationships, but she was the business she handled the business. So the fact that she was just paying out $75 to something and didn't know what it was, not buying it. But anyway, that was the insurance policy. So Petrosino saying, like, you know, every time we come to her with something, every time we confront her about something we find out, she starts changing her story. You know, they come there for clarification on something they didn't tell her that they didn't tell. She didn't tell them that they find out. You know, she keep going back and forth. So Petrosino saying, like, yeah, when somebody's telling you the truth, it doesn't change. Even without her changing stories and stuff like that. There's nothing to show that she actually pulled the trick. So now we're at November 3rd, 1992. This is 2 weeks after Chuck's murder. So Petrosino is saying that they went back for a second time to talk to Ashton. And we hear Pat LaLama, the journalist, saying it's, you know, it could be his connection to the drugs that got Chuck murdered. But the cops came up with this plan to confront Ashton again. And they kind of make up, you know, cops can lie to you. Cops can make up shit. They can lie to you. So they started to, come in there with the guy, you know, under the guise of like, hey, we know this drug dealer that you owe. You know, we know you got a connection with this drug dealer. We know he's involved in this murder. So tell me what you know. But the problem with that is, like, if you just out in left field, they know you're just making up shit. You know, like say he wasn't on drugs. Say they didn't have any indication that Ashton was on drugs, and they just go in there and say, "Hey, we know you own drugs, and you owe this drug dealer." And then Ashton be like, "What? You just making up shit." But the fact that he is on drugs, he owed a drug dealer money. These are good guess lies that he may, you know, a drug dealer may be involved. So this is the angle they're gonna present to Ashton. So we see this reenactment. They're in the interrogation room. They got the tape recorder going. So they just tell Ashton, you know, we know you got connections. It'll be really helpful, and it'll make you look good if you just give us a name of any of these drug dealers that you're associated with or have worked with. So Ashton gets a little panicked, and then he gives up Bob Pryor. This guy named Bob Pryor. And this is the guy that they show him reenacting him buying the Nubian from earlier. I was saying Nubian, but it's Nubian, N-U-B-A-I-N. I never heard of it. I'm gonna look that up real quick. Okay, so this must be the opioid. So this Bob Pryor was his plug for this Nubian. And so Bob was a physical trainer at the gym that Ashton went to. Okay, so that's how they became known to each other. So Bob Pryor is one of those guys who his name comes up all the time. He would have been known to the Phoenix Police Department. So he's just like that name that's known to the cops. So they already know about him. They know his rap sheet, everything. The cops are not strangers to this Bob Pryor. So they also have a informant that knows Bob Pryor. So September of 1993, the detective is able to get in contact with Dan Goddard, who is one of the detective's CIs. So they ask the CI if he knows Ashton, and he tells the cops that, yeah, I met him once. And there was a conversation related to Dan Goddard that Ashton had told Pryor that he hated his stepdad so much he was willing to pay to get him killed. So now he's asking the CI, hey, do you know where Bob Pryor was on October 20th? 1992. The CI said he was with Bob Pryor and they were driving around and they stopped at a gas station. It was right around the corner from Chuck Gold's house. Now, I don't know if the CI knows that they were around the corner from Chuck Gold's house. He just know they were at a gas station. The cop probably asked him what gas station. He told him, he's like, okay, the cop keep that in the back of his head. That's right around from Chuck Gold's house. So he said that Pryor was wearing a heavy jacket. He's got a gun, and the CI said it was a small caliber pistol, probably a .22. And he said there was a silencer on it. Wait a minute. So this CI is driving this dude around. He got on his heavy jacket. He pulls out a gun, and he has a fucking silencer on it. And you don't say anything? You the informant, and you never told your handler? So Bob gets out of the car with the .22 caliber under his jacket. And remember, Chuck had those .22 caliber cases around him. So this is lining up. And we see this reenactment of Bob Pryor walking away from Goddard's car. Goddard is the CI. And so the CI said Bob Pryor gets out. He leaves. He walks away. He disappears for a period of time. And he didn't know where he went. And suddenly, Bob Pryor and Ashton moved up to the top of the list of suspects. And so the CI gets out, leaving the detectives with all of this info. So when detectives start looking at Bob Pryor, they found out about this another unrelated case that police took $9,000 in cash and a bunch of weapons from his house. And Bob Pryor had been complaining that he wants that stuff back. So this is the perfect situation to get Bob Pryor down to the station. So cops are always looking for, you know, past warrants or something. I was watching something where they had a lead on this girl and they had took her phone for something and they called her like, hey, matter of fact, I think it was on the first 48 and they called her like, hey, we got your phone. Come down here to get it. So that's what they're using with this Bob Pryor. Like, hey, we got your cash and your shit. Come down here to the station to get it. So he got down there and of course, you know, they didn't give him his guns back or his money. They wanted to interrogate him. And so he get down to the station and
but just a few minutes into his conversation with detectives, he realizes, oh, wait a minute, this is about a murder. Now the detectives have the attention of Bob Pryor. It's their chance to say to him, so, Bob, just how much were you paid to carry out a hit on Chuck Gold?
And eventually he starts to crack. Bob Pryor tells them it was $9,000. And the police had seized that when they took his guns and drugs.
Holy shit. So they had the guy all this whole time. That money that they seized from his house and those guns that they seized from his house on their unrelated charge, that was his payout for the hit. How do they not put them two together? I mean, how do they not put that together earlier? Anyway, so Bob, he gives himself up. Immediately, like he just cracked, he gave it up, and then he admits that he was involved in his plan, but he got a lot more. So now this is where he started negotiating his sentencing and shit like that. All of a sudden, he's an open book. He's like, "Oh, hey, let's make a deal. I got a bunch of information, and I'm thinking that Carol has some shit to do with it. We know Ashton has something to do with it." But I'm thinking it's about to get a lot deeper. So here we go. So he tells the detective Kara Gold was the mastermind. So it wasn't Ashton. So I thought Carol just knew about it and she was helping Ashton cover it up. No, she's the fucking mastermind. Oh, Carol the Playboy Bunny is the mastermind. Wow. So faced with the threat of getting divorced. But if she got divorced from Chuck, she would get half the money. So it's not like she, I don't know. So Holly is saying that, you know, she was a Playboy bunny. She lost that. She didn't really lose that. I thought she just gave it up. Well, I guess, you know, she had did it for 5 years in the eyes of Playboy. Remember, old for a Playboy bunny, old is like, well, what was it? 28, some shit like that. She aged out of being a Playboy bunny. But she got married to that other guy, Katini. He died. She got the insurance. She blew that. She married Chuck. They got a thriving business, which she was right there at the beginning with them. So, and her kids are older. So what would she be losing? Threat of a divorce. She's no longer raising some young kids. I don't know. I don't see that as a, it has to be something more than that. But that's what Holly is theorizing, that she was so afraid of losing everything that she wanted to stop it. I don't know. I don't buy that. I think it was something else. But anyway, doing the interview with Bob Pryor, he gave some statements that implicated Carol and Ashton and said that they both hired him for $9,000. Not only that, that wasn't the first attempt. So evidently, Carol and Ashton put rat poison in Chuck's dinner. He didn't die. He didn't like the way it tasted and threw this shit out. He like, who, what is this? So he took a bite of it and threw it away. So he didn't even eat it. So the cops go back to the stable and they arrest both Ashton and Carol for murder and conspiracy to commit murder on Chuck Gold. So now they got Carol down to the station. They want to talk to her some more. So this time she clams up. She lawyers up. Lawyer. There was an episode, I think Chicago PD. They had this guy in the interrogation room. They started talking to him and he said, he says, lawyer. So me and my wife always say that when we were watching these, you know, these true crime shows, like lawyer. So yeah, she lawyered up, man. which is smart. That's what you're supposed to do. So now it's this crook's hearsay, you know, Bob Pryor, this known crook with a rap sheet, is he said against Carol, you know, running a business, ex-Playboy bunny, as far as we know, don't have any, never done any criminal activity. It's his word against hers. It looks pretty good. You know, she has a good alibi. It's looking pretty good. It's looking pretty good for her. But Ashton, they really don't have any physical evidence against him either, but they charge him with conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree. They charge him and Bob Pryor. So they release Carol. And so after they release her, they go to talk to John and Cheryl. John and Sharon Novoselsky. Novoselsky. John and Sharon Novoselsky, who are good friends of Carol and Chuck's. So he talked to them before, but he wanted to double back, talk to them again now that he has a little bit more information, just to see if he could find out.
The Novoselskys end up giving the detective a piece of information that gets him one step closer to solving the case.
John and Sharon indicated that it was a really, really bad time in Chuck and Carol's marriage.
But probably the biggest piece of information they tell the detective is that they know Chuck did not know about any kind of insurance policy.
Chuck had been denied insurance, I'm assuming life insurance, because of health issues. The detective was able to obtain handwriting samples for Chuck and other family members, but the handwriting analysts told him that Chuck did not sign the application for the insurance.
And that's the gotcha moment right there. That's her hands on it. So the analyst finds out that his signature, Chuck's signature on that application for insurance, was actually Carol's signature. There we go. That's her hands on it. Now her hands are dirty. And not only that, Carol had hired an attorney to try to get that money released from the insurance company. But remember, the insurance company called the cops and was like, hey, is anybody that's tied to this money, this insurance policy, this claim, are they a suspect? And the cops probably like, yeah, the beneficiary is a suspect. They didn't have enough to hold the insurance company from not paying it. So the insurance company ended up paying out that money. So now we in December of 1994, 2 years after. This is when the trial starts. And this is the trial for Ashton and Bob Pryor. And we see this headline says, Black Bart killing goes to trial. Pair accused in shooting for hire of quick draw artist. It's a deadlock jury in the end. So the jury deadlocked and is eventually declared a mistrial in 1995. Holy shit. So it was a hung jury. So the jury just couldn't get there. They couldn't make the connection. I'm pretty sure the defense is even if they got, well, they didn't say who the hung jury was for. Did they have the same trial? Was it separate trials? Because Bob pretty much fucking confessed. So I guess the defense for Ashton would be Bob went over there looking for money that Ashton owed him and ended up killing Chuck. So I can see that, but they said a mistrial. They didn't say for who. Okay. So not long after, okay, so it was Bob's mistrial. So not long after Bob's mistrial, he managed to get himself into trouble. So he got unrelated charges on federal unrelated charges, having to deal with drug distribution. So what he did was, so he got these federal drug charges. All right. So what he managed to do was plead down his sentence for that charge. And in return, he's going to testify against Ashton and Carol. Okay. So I guess he didn't testify in the first one against them. So now he's going to testify against Ashton and Carol in order to get a lesser sentence for this federal drug charge. So in 1995, on the 2nd of August, Ashton and Carol are re-arrested. And we see this picture of Carol. Holy, is this the same? This must be, yeah, this got to be the current picture of her, because she like a raisin. And we hear La Llama, remember the journalist, she's saying that she's covered a number of these murder for hire cases. And it's usually spouse on spouse. So there's, you know, and the spouse's killer think they're so clever. So this is par for the course. And any, like, you look at that true crime, this shit happens all the time, man. So they always make a mistake. It's always something simple, like lying about a goddamn insurance. Anytime money is involved, you gotta know, man. Because, again, these insurance companies, they don't want to release money, so it's going to get investigated. And then people can't keep their mouth closed about money, so she ended up telling a friend. The friend knew about the insurance. So they got her. So this insurance document, that's the thing that's going to turn over the jury. So when they rearrest her, they bring her in again, thinking, you know, she got to know we're getting close. So she's either going to confess or slip up and give us more information. But she started to make statements that, in, you know, opening up to her involvement. So she makes this statement that you're on the right track, but the wrong train. The fuck does that mean? She never clarifies what that means. But I mean, if at that point, you might as well just go and give it up. If you giving them hints and shit, what are you doing? And so Stephanie is saying that on the day that she was arrested for that second time, she never heard from Carol again. Not a single person in the family ever heard from her again. She never called to say it's not true. She never, you know, she never denied it to the family. Nothing. Nothing. That's, I don't know, man. It sounds like a guilty person to me. So August 4th, 1997, trial of Ashton and Carol started. So they're having a joint trial. And we see this headline, stepson confesses in Black Bart killing. So during the course of the trial, Ashton pleads guilty to conspiracy and is later sentenced to 18 years in prison. And now the trial against his mom. Okay, so it wasn't a joint trial. So the trial against his mom proceeds. At the end of the trial, the jury comes back with guilty on two counts. And we see this headline, wife convicted in slaying of entertainer Black Bart. So she's guilty on conspiracy and murder in the first degree. She's sentenced. Her sentence is 25 to life. And we see another headline says Bunny gets life for ordering hit, but she does have a possibility of receiving parole. So because of that deal that Bob Pryor cut, he was sentenced to 20 years in a medium security prison. So he worked. It worked out for him. Now, I'm pretty sure that's on top of whatever federal charges he got.
I felt my dad got the justice he deserved. It was tough being in court every day. But sentencing took place a month later, where I was able to give my victim impact statement. I apologized to the judge, but I told Carol to rot in hell. And that's one of the hardest things that's been for me, because I loved her. She was part of my family. And she broke my heart.
Carol's ultimate fear was losing her wealth and losing her share of a thriving business. Playboy can give you the taste of the high life, but that doesn't last forever. And when Carol was afraid she was going to lose her marriage, her lifestyle, her business, she was prepared to kill to make sure that didn't happen.
And that's it for this episode. Send all your questions and comments to docutalkthrough@gmail.com. That's docutalkthrough@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.